ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's time for our talking point, and this morning we're going to be talking about champagne. Well, you could sort of call it the king of wines, one of the most popular drinks in the world, used to celebrate sporting victories, family events and celebrations. It's drunk at parties all through the year, but especially during the festive season and on New Year's Eve. But how did that happen? How did a sparkling wine from rural France conquer the world? Our guest this morning is Dr. Graham Harding, a distinguished wine historian at the University of Oxford, whose groundbreaking research has illuminated the complex cultural and commercial evolution of champagne. A renowned expert in wine history, he has made significant contributions to understanding the intricate relationships between wine production, trade, and cultural identity, and that is so important with champagne. He wrote the book Champagne in Britain, 1800 to 1914, How the British Transformed a French Luxury. And his exceptional contributions have been recognised with consecutive Prix de la History Awards in 2022 and 2023. Graham Harding is our guest. He can tell me what those awards are. Graham, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you, Rod.
What are those Prix de la... whatever?
It's the Organisation Internationale du Vin. So it's a French-organised, basically wine promotion body, sets standards and awards these various prizes. And I got lucky to, you know, be part of it a couple of years running. So that's, so, you know, for an Englishman writing a book which says that, you know, the British created modern champagne, I thought it was very generous of them.
Indeed, it's very nice when any French person congratulates someone from the UK. Tell me then, your book was about how Britain transformed the French luxury. What was it like prior to that? When does it start? When does champagne begin? We often hear about Dom Perignon being the person who sort of creates it or starts it, but was that the case? Was it always being made?
Well, champagne has been, or wine rather, has been made in the Champagne area of northern France for a couple of thousand years. And you know, within the last 1,000 years, people have started to recognise that, you know, it's about 900 AD. You find people talking about champagne, the wine of champagne, and its fizziness. And it's the problem, though, with fizziness was that if the wine starts to warm up, the fermentation starts and the barrels start to burst. So oxygen gets in and the wine spoils. And there's an extraordinary 13th century poem, you know, so 700 years ago now, where it was called The Battle of the Wines. It was a bit like a sort of decanter, World Wine Awards, that sort of stuff done for the French king. And champagne gets called Dom Pétard. So that was the first Dom. And Dom Pétard actually means, you know, basic English translation would be Sir Farter, because it breaks the barrels. And that quality hangs on around champagne for the next few hundred years, with nobody really liking it like that. And it's only in England in the sort of 17th century that people get the taste for sparkling wine.
When does it go from the Champagne region to beyond that? You know, the rest of France and then throughout Europe and then across the Channel?
Well, it gets across the Channel pretty early on, because the English at one point, you know, in the sort of Hundred Years' War, controlled a bit of Champagne, Champagne territory. So they got a taste for the wines of Champagne, and they're, you know, easy to get to London. So, you know, that's because, you know, we didn't grow any, make any wine at that stage in England. So we had to import it all. And, you know, for the last 600 years, basically, England has been the number one or number two importer of sparkling wine and wine. And see, what I think happens is that the barrels sit on the quayside, most of them spoil, get hot, they spoil, oxygen gets in, but some of them don't. And people try this and think, hey, I like the bubbles. And so in the 17th century, you know, so we're talking 400 years ago now, the Restoration Court, the king's been in exile, comes back after the Commonwealth, and he comes back with a taste for French wine. And he has a chap in the in his court who's a Frenchman, the Duke Evremond, and he's got a connection to Champagne, a supply chain. So he starts plugging it into the British court. And everybody thinks, wow, this is good stuff. And you get poetry, you get plays talking about the way that Champagne, you know, revives languishing lovers, makes everybody happy and gay. And I think that's the point at which Champagne starts to migrate towards a sparkling wine.
So is it something specific about the Champagne region? Because I'm sure that there are other parts of Europe, say, certainly in Italy, because we know Prosecco is also hugely popular and well-known, and in Spain and possibly in Germany as well, that would have the same sort of, you know, soil, perhaps, or the same sort of climate that allows Champagne or the grapes to be grown in Champagne and then become Champagne as we know it. I mean, what was special about what was happening in Champagne?
Firstly, it's a very specific... Well, first thing is that it's right at the northern edge of cultivation. You know, go any further north during that, you know, that period, the grapes wouldn't grow, wouldn't ripen. But the thing is, you need a high acid, you know, low sugar wine to make good sparkling wine. If not, the yeast just can't deal with the pressure that gets built up as the wine starts to ferment. So you've got a climate and a soil, which is lots of limestone, which is just perfect for those sort of white wines and red wines. Now, the other thing that's happening is that because the English controlled it, it was close to them, you know, they had a marketplace there. And the third thing is that because Champagne's so far north, it gets cold in winter. You know, a statement of the beginning, obvious, of course. But what happens then is the fermentation shuts down, but there's still a little bit of sugar left in the grapes. So when it starts to get a bit warmer, the secondary fermentation starts, and you don't get that in Italy with Prosecco, really, which is made in a very different way. So although the Champagne method is used in lots of other countries, it has to be called the classic method, yes. Not the Champagne method. Because the other thing about the people of Champagne is they have bloody good lawyers.
Yes.
And they take enormous steps and spend a lot of money protecting their brand name. So I don't know if you know this, Rob, but there's a village in Switzerland called Champagne. They make perfectly decent red and white wine, but they can't use their name because the Champagne guys have got it locked up.
And, you know, why not? They need to protect... Because the thing about Champagne, as I'm sure we'll discover if we don't already know, is, you know, they do it properly. There are, you know, only there are many Champagne houses, but there's a limited number, and they want to make sure that their brand is not diluted or that brand name is not diluted. They want to make sure that the product they put out is as respected as it should be, because they don't want to have Method Champagne Noir or Australian Champagne or whatever it was, even though it's very, very good, it's not Champagne.
You're absolutely right. And that was a famous law court decision in France in 1887, which said, if it's not from Champagne with a capital C, then you can't call it Champagne with a small c. I mean, you know, translated roughly. And they've hung on to that ever since. And as you say, you know, Australian sparkling wine, you know, whether it's Adelaide Hills, whether it's the Victorian Hills, whether it's Tasmania, is great stuff. But you've got to find another name for it.
Mm. We certainly encourage, if you've got any questions or comments about Champagne and something you'd like to know, we've got one from Jen in Bondi in just a moment, but we've got Anne in Randwick first. Good morning, Anne.
Oh, hi, Rod and Graham.
Hi.
Hi. In the 70s, we had this horrible stuff called Porphyry Pearl that everybody said was champagne, and I used to think it was the most shocking drink. And then I went to France in about 2007, and went to REMS, and we did a tour of Tattenjay caves. That was, I think, run by the Benedictine nuns in the monks in the medieval time. And they told us the reason that champagne is so expensive is because in the bottles, it's hand-turned every 5 years in the long caves there. And when we came up to the surface from the caves, they gave us a glass of this thing that I thought was just the best elixir that I had ever tasted. And I've been a devotee ever since. And then, do you remember Alan Saunders when he did the food program?
Yes, I do, yes.
He interviewed a number of worldwide chefs, and one of the chefs said that his favourite drink, his favourite meal was omelette with champagne for breakfast.
Fair enough. Thanks very much for that, Anne. Graham Harding is our guest. Graham, so a couple of things that Anne was talking about there. The tours, one of the things also about the Champagne region is they sell themselves superbly well. Most of those big champagne houses, you can go on tours. Tell me what you see when you go on them.
When you go on tour, when you most often you start off in a big, you know, ground floor room, probably with some barrels there, big barrels which they use to store the various wines, probably a tasting room somewhere there. And then, you know, somewhere, maybe it's in the middle, maybe in the corner, there's steps down, and you descend, you know, 50 to 100 feet down, often quite big, wide steps, because they used to have to manhandle barrels up there. And you go down into these big pits that they've dug out of the chalk. And it's because of that chalk, which underlies the whole Champagne region, that you've got this absolutely constant temperature down there, perfect cool, damp conditions, which don't vary very much from year to year, from day to day. And that possession of those cellars, which the Romans started digging first of all to build their cities and their roads, that's what makes the champagne so possible in that region. And when you get down there, there's this labyrinth of tunnels, typically with racks and racks of champagne stacked up on the side, rows and rows of bottles. And every now and then, these days it's pretty rare, but it used to be much more common, there's a crack, there's an explosion. A bottle has broken, the pressure inside has broken the bottle. And they'll have little gutters running down the centre of the tunnels, which collects the wine that's been, come out of the broken bottle. Now, these days, they've got the temperature control pretty well down to a fine art. But in the 18th century, in the 19th century, no, they didn't. So if you've got a hot summer, you would find 5, 10, 15, 20, even 50% of the bottles breaking, just exploding. And there's a report from a British traveller in the 1850s, 1860s, saying it's like the rattle of artillery fire down there, all these exploding bottles.
That's not the case now. And you're right. These caves go on for, well, it seems like miles. There are just so many of them, and there are thousands of bottles that are kept there. How long does it take from when the grapes are picked and eventually find their way into the bottles before those bottles are opened? How long are they down underground?
That varies, Rod. You can do the process probably in, you know, a couple of years, 3 years. But most of the houses, most of the Grand Marque, the big houses, the names we know, they'll age the wine a lot longer. And the reason they do that is that it picks up flavour from the yeast cells in the bottles during the first part of the ageing process. And it carries on getting more complexity of taste, more interesting aromas with time. So some of these wines are down there for 5 or even 10 years before they get their let out into the market, which is one of the reasons why, you know, at least they will tell you, you know, champagne has to be so expensive. And it's a tricky process, but they need to hang on to the stock And what pretty much anybody in the champagne industry will tell you, and I think this is right, is that if you can possibly afford it, buy a bottle from a supermarket, don't drink it immediately. If you hang on to it for 6 months or a year even, it will get better because the wine will sort of come together and start to acquire a bit more complexity. And that, you know, by and large, is a good thing. But it's a council of perfection. If you can afford to do it, do it. If not,
okay. So Paul in Newcastle has a question that relates to that. He says, what's the best way to store bottles of champagne and what temperature is best? So if you buy, you know, half a dozen of them or even more than that, and you bring them home and you think, okay, yes, sure, we could pop them open tomorrow. You're saying don't do that, wait 6 months or so, even a year. How do you keep them? Do you put them in the fridge? Do you put them somewhere else? Do you store them standing up, lying on their side? What do you do with them?
Best thing is to store them on their side in any cool... Cool is important, but a stable temperature is also important. So if the temperature is going up and down, then that's what kills wine quicker than anything else. So that's why keep them somewhere where the temperature doesn't vary too much, or if it varies, varies slowly over the course of the year. Fridge is fine for, you know, a week or so. And if you keep them any longer in the fridge, though, make sure they're on their side again, because the fridge tends to be quite dry, so it dries out the cork, and when the cork gets dried out, then oxygen starts to get in, and that tends to spoil the wine. But if you're just, you know, if you're going to drink it, you know, this coming weekend, bang it straight in the fridge, leave it there for, you know, 6 to 12 hours, and it will be just perfect.
Okay. Jen in Bondi says, she'd like your opinion on Pet Nat, which I tried recently on a visit to France. Pet Nats are sparkling wines made in a manner that predates the so-called traditional method used in champagne. Rather than induce a second fermentation in the bottle to create the bubbles that champagne producers do, makers of Pet Nat simply bottle the wine before the initial fermentation has ended. The result is softly fizzy, sometimes lightly sweet, from residual grape sugars, usually hazy with unfiltered yeast particles and typically sealed with a crown cap instead of a cork. So I'm sure I've mispronounced that, but what do you make of what Jen is saying?
Well, I mean, you've very precisely described what Pet Nat is. It's an older method of making champagne, and one of the reasons why they keep it very lightly sparkling is, again, because of this bottle problem, that it wasn't until the 17th century that they worked out how to make stronger glass that would hold the pressure, because the pressure in a standard champagne is double that of a car tyre. You know, you've got a lot of pressure under there. Pet Nat, you know, which is pétillance naturelle, it's a more natural fermentation. It takes a bit less time, but as you say, you finish up with a wine that's a bit cloudy, often tastes a bit cidery rather than standard grape wines, but it's enjoying quite a comeback these days, and it used to be very much looked down on, but now people are making increasingly interesting wines with it. And, you know, because you're not paying typically for a big brand, typically you should be able to get it at a slightly better price.
Can you call it champagne though?
Absolutely not. No, the lawyers will be on you like a shot.
Okay, let's talk about taking the cork off the bottle. You've got to be very careful. You do not want that to shoot across the room and hit somebody in the eye. What should you do? What's the best way to take the cork off a bottle of champagne?
Okay, the warmer the bottle, the more gas, the more pressure there is inside it. And obviously, if you shake it, you also get more pressure. So the first thing is to keep it cold, keep it still. Then what it's worth remembering is that that cork can come out at up to 50 miles an hour, and it's a perfect size to fit into the eye socket. So the next thing to do is to make absolutely sure that bottle is pointed away from you, away from your guests, and avoid the light fittings. Okay, so that's step two. Then what you do is you unwrap the little wire cage, which is needed to hold the cork in, and then hold the bottle, the base of the bottle in your right hand, cork in your left hand. Okay, so you're right-handed. And then what you do is you gently try to turn the base of the bottle. So you're not trying to turn the cork, you're trying to turn the bottle, get more leverage that way. And you may have to sort of wiggle it about a little bit. But then the ideal is not to do what all the racing drivers do, which is to spray everybody in sight with a loud bang, but for the cork to come out with a soft, people talk about whisper when the cork comes out. So you let the pressure out slowly. And what that does, it means that you don't get much chance. It can happen. You don't get much chance of the wine bubbling out of the bottle and losing, 5%, 10% of your hard-earned and most expensive wine. So that's the way to open the bottle. But main thing, don't let it be pointed at you. Don't let it be pointed at anybody else.
But if you've got a clear backyard or something behind you, and can you fire the cork off? Does that make a difference?
You can fire the cork off.
Yeah.
You will. I mean, the record for cork firing is about 65 yards, I think.
Wow.
So if you can beat that, you're doing well.
That's fantastic. So just again, I mean, to get back to the serving of the champagne, if you have kept it in that cool, dark place, I'm guessing, if it needs to be dark as well as cool, and then you intend to serve it, should you put it in the fridge for, a couple of hours or 5 minutes or something? Does that make a difference?
Oh, it's certainly worth doing that because champagne is one of those wines which is definitely best served cold. You don't want it too cold because if it's too cold, it kills the flavour. And I mean, as you probably know, if you've got a party, you open this bottle of wine, and you take one sip and you think, "Oh my gosh, no!" The best thing to do is put it straight in the freezer, because if it's really cold, it kills the flavour. So you don't want it too cold, but you certainly want it. And people in the 19th century talked about, spring water temperature. So about, 12, 15 degrees centigrade, something Celsius, something like that. But definitely put it in the fridge before you serve. Yep.
There once was a time, up until maybe the 1980s, but perhaps it's changed elsewhere, where the glass was really important. That these days you're much more likely to have champagne in a flute, whereas I always thought up until the 1970s or so, you would have champagne in one of those glasses that was allegedly designed to look like Marie Antoinette. So is the glass that you use, does that make an important, or is that important, does that make a difference to the taste of the champagne?
It does make a difference that the saucer-shaped glass doesn't really start being used very much until about a couple of hundred years ago. And it became all the rage in Victorian England. The French never adopted the saucer shape. They always said a flute is better. But what was happening in Britain at that time, the Victorians, we think of them as being a bit stodgy and sort of, not very up for entertainment. But they loved sensation. And the great sensation was pink champagne in a saucer glass. So you've got the white froth on top of this, rose-coloured pink liquid, looked fabulous. But the problem is that the bubbles, which carry the taste and the aroma to your nose, just disappear. They just dissipate quickly in that wide open space. So now what we have is these more tulip-shaped glass with the rim curves in. So there's a smaller opening at the top than there is in the body of the glass, if that makes sense.
Indeed.
And that holds in the bubble and it holds in the flavour better, much, much better than the coupe or saucer shape. But you're right about Marie Antoinette. There is this myth that it was modelled on. People disagree whether it was her left breast or her right breast, but almost certainly a myth. Only starts to occur, at least as far as I've found, after World War II.
Really?
Yep. If you've got, if anybody of your listeners knows an earlier story of that, I'd love to hear it. But I found it in a British popular newspaper in the 1950s, and I haven't traced it back earlier than that. But what it has meant is that Kate Moss, Claudia Schiffer, I think there's some other models, have had glasses modelled on their
wow.
breast.
Amazing.
By various designers.
All right, let's talk to Vesna in Canberra. Hello, Vesna.
Hello, Mr. Quinn.
Oh, it's been a long time, indeed.
It has. I listen to you, I just don't call.
Thank you very much. Now, you've got a question that I think a lot of people would be, certainly interested to know the answer to. What would you like to ask?
I do. Look, I've got a bottle of that old Seppelt's champagne, and I don't think Seppelt's exist anymore, that was gifted to me on my 21st birthday. And, Rod, I left 21 a long time ago, and I wondered about its viability.
Okay, very good question, Vesna, and thank you very much for that. Nice to hear from you. So, yeah, people do think, here's a vintage from 1929 or from the 40s, from the 1800s or something. Seppelt would have been called champagne back before champagne started imposing their trademark on Australian wines. But how long can you keep it? If it's looked after, if it's kept in a cool, dark place, can you keep it 100 years? Or 20 years, maybe 20 years in Vesna's case.
You're risking it. You're very much risking it. Most champagne, like most white wines, really, doesn't have the capacity to age that well. And it should still be drinkable, but it will, by and large, it will lose the fizz. Slowly, that carbon dioxide, which powers it, leaks out through the cork, because the cork's always, there's a little bit of, they're slightly porous, so that the oxygen can get in and the gas does get out. The other thing that will happen is that they will acquire, the colour will slowly change. They'll get more yellow rather than white. And the flavours can go just a bit oxidised. They're more likely to taste like a sherry than a champagne with a lot of age, unfortunately. I mean, the oldest champagne anybody currently has drunk is actually about 200 years old, because they found 170 bottles, something like that, in a shipwreck off Finland.
Yes.
Verve Clicquot, probably 1788 vintage, 1782, nobody knows for sure. And they said it was sweet, which is not surprising, because there was a lot of people like their champagne sweet, particularly the Russians. And just a touch of oak, which makes sense, because they would have made it in oak, they would have stored it in oak, so it would have an oak flavour. And they said just a few tiny bubbles was all that was left. But, it still had something about it. So, if you've got Verve Clicquot and you can keep it underwater for 200 years, then you may have a chance.
Yes, but if you've just kept it in your house for, say, 30 or 40 years, I guess once you take the cork out, once you pop the cork, you're going to know whether or not it's drinkable, because it might be flat.
Absolutely. There's a pretty high chance that it will be flat. I don't think I've ever drunk any champagnes older than about 15 years, perhaps 20 years, and that was a good brand, a good producer, and it was showing its age.
Okay, what about that story? I don't know if it's a myth or not, that if you put a spoon in the bottle, that will keep it fizzy.
That's a wonderful myth. It's mainly it's not an American myth. It's mainly European, and obviously. Hit Australia as well. It doesn't have any effect at all, except that most people then put it in the fridge. And the wine in the fridge, because it's cold, it suppresses the carbon dioxide, so it suppresses the foaming quality, the bubbles. If it's cold, really cold fridge, it sort of shuts down the production of the bubbles. So if you drink it the next day, it's going to be it'll probably be okay. But it has, unfortunately, the spoon has no preservative effect unfortunately.
But, I mean, you can't keep – once the cork's out of the bottle, as it were, I know there are some sort of things you can put on it and seal it, but really you should drink the whole bottle at once, not one person, of course, but share it around with your friends. I mean, can you keep it – how long can you keep it open?
Keeping it open, you really don't want to do more than a day, I'd say. Okay. And, you know, if you – tend to find yourself in that situation, then you can buy, as you say, special stoppers, sort of spring-loaded, which hold in the gas pretty well. You know, you can do 2 or 3 days without a problem, because, again, it a bit depends on the quality of the underlying, you know, the wine. Because I went once, I was lucky enough to go to a tasting by the two Krug brothers in, you know, French champagne makers with a fantastic reputation. It was a long while ago. Yeah. But what they said was the true test of a champagne is what does it taste like next day when the bubbles have gone? Uh-huh. Because then you really get to know, it's like any white wine. If you drink it warm and it still tastes decent, then you've got something pretty special.
Okay.
I recommend it, but it's a good test.
Take some more calls in a moment and some text messages as well, 0467 922 702. You can call us 1-300-800-222. We've got Sally. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, gentlemen. I can drink a bottle of champagne all by myself. Okay. I'm just wondering about champagne. I don't know a thing about winemaking or champagne making, so I'm sorry if this question sounds silly, but I've got no idea, so I'm just asking a question. How come we've always had champagne from white grapes, but we've never had champagne from red grapes? Is there a reason why?
Look, it's not a silly question. I was going to ask it myself. So, I mean, is there a red version, a red grape version of champagne?
Yes, there is. But before that, what you can do with black grapes in champagne, and the average mix, the average blend for a champagne, it's not one grape, it's three grapes. Two black grapes, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier, and one white grape, which is Chardonnay. And because the juice of all the grapes, almost all the grapes in the world, is white or grey, it's certainly not, it's not coloured. If you press the grapes gently, you get a clear juice. The juice that's produced by the black grapes, like Pinot Noir, has more red fruit flavours to it. It has a bit more body to it, a bit more weight to it, which is why it's part of the blend. But then there's another champagne, which is called Blanc de Noir, which basically means white wine from red grapes. And they only use the Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and it's still that. It's a little bit more yellow, a little bit more gold than a champagne made just with Chardonnay, which you would call a Blanc de Blanc, which is a white wine from white grapes. So the answer to your question, which is a very good one, is that, yes, you can make champagne with red grapes, but if you want to make it champagne only with red grapes, then it's often tends to be a bit more expensive, a bit more special, and often a really interesting wine.
And would you, I mean, could you buy them? What sort of brands are you talking about there if you went looking for champagne made from red grapes?
Most of the big houses, you know, the brands that we all know, most of them will have a Blanc de Noir, but it will be more expensive, certainly, and you may not find it in the standard liquor store.
Okay. Thanks very much for that question, Sally. Just on the price of champagne, it seems, I'm not sure what the situation is in France or in England, but in Australia it's almost doubled in the last year or so, last year and a half. Why has that happened?
It's a very good question, that. I can't tell you why. We've had the same thing. I think what's happening is there's a combination of things going on here. One is that although, you know, the champagne makers don't like to talk about this very much, is that climate change is affecting champagne. As the temperature warms up, two things start to happen. First of all, you need to take more time and travel to get to the sort of champagne we know. So the process gets a bit longer. And the second thing is that what climate change has done, it's not just warmer temperatures. And the temperatures are up 2 degrees. Average temperature is up 2 degrees, I think, in the last 60 years in Champagne. And the harvest date has moved by 20 days. So it's 20 days earlier now than it was 30 years ago. But what that also brings with it is more just dramatic weather. So 2021 in Champagne, they lost, quite a lot of people lost 30, 40, 50%, even more of their grapes to late frosts. Because what happens is that spring comes, it's a nice warm winter, early spring, but vines wake up and think, aha, time to get going. And they start to put out buds. And then February or March, bang, frost hits, your crop's gone. Or hail in June, which is another thing that has really hit the champagne makers. So there's less product out there. And I think that's a big factor, which is driving price. Okay. But the other thing is that worldwide, what the pandemic did was it encouraged people to go and buy champagne. And they really had a pandemic boom. And they took advantage, they put the prices up, and now they see no reason to bring them down again.
Hmm. Wayne in Oakley says, I've seen people drinking champagne with strawberries in the flute. Does this enhance the wine, or should you not do it? And what about, you know, people putting a cube of sugar in a champagne cocktail or something like that? Can you add something to champagne?
Well, there are some great champagne cocktails, and yes, many of them will have a touch of sugar to it. And you know, there's the classics of Bellini, which is peach juice and champagne. The strawberries is a lovely story. There's a 19th century story, because I'm, you know, fundamentally a 19th century historian. Fabulous story, but a London alderman, you know, so big wig in the city of London, and somebody tells him, if you put a strawberry in the bottom of your glass, then you won't get drunk, no matter how much you drink. So he does that and wakes up next morning with the most terrible headache. So he complains to his doctor, and the doctor says, must have been a bad strawberry, sir.
Beautiful. Sonia also wants to know, what about storage of the champagne by, you know, where you're buying it, the supermarket or the bottle shop? If you go in and buy them from, specialist, liquor outlets or from your local supermarket, how can you be sure that they have stored the champagne the right way?
I'm afraid the answer is you can't. I guess the best thing you can do is actually think, is it something you're going to drink very soon, or is it something that you want to really keep? If it's something you do want to keep, then probably a specialist store will be better. If it's something you're going to be drinking this weekend, then, you know, it doesn't matter too much because the supermarkets will have such a high turnover.
Right.
Where you want to be aware is somebody in a small store, small stock, which doesn't get turned over very frequently.
What can you tell about the champagne from the label? What information should be on the label if you're really interested in your champagne?
If you're really interested, okay. First thing is there a vintage date? Champagne, about three times every 10 years, the climate conditions, the weather conditions are just perfect. And what they will do is they will make a wine of that year's grapes only. And that's a vintage wine. It'll have a date on it. You know, Dom Perignon 2010, something like that. Otherwise, you will have no date on it. It will be NV or non-vintage or sometimes multi-vintage. Because the great thing about champagne is that almost alone in France, what you can do is you can blend wine from different years. So you keep all the big makers, all the big producers will do is they will keep stocks of reserve wine and they'll blend it each year. So that the wine you taste this year with the non-vintage or multi-vintage or NV on the label is going to be just the same as the wine with that name and that label last year. And it will be the same again next year. So it's a remarkable feat of blending. So that's the first thing to look for. Alcohol levels don't vary very much in Champagne. It's usually about 12%, 12.5%. So that information is there, but doesn't really tell you very much, because all champagne, all sparkling wine is about the same. What you can, and this is getting very nerdish, is you can look for the letters RM, which stands for Récolte Manipulateur, which in English means a grower and a maker. So that's typically a small farm, perhaps, where small, medium farm, where the guys who grow the wine also make the wine. And that's what RM stands for. So what you're getting there is a much more individual product. It will vary probably much more year to year. It won't have the insurance that, you know, the big brands bring. You know, what big brands do is they guarantee that consistency. So you can look for that on the label. And those are probably the most useful things to look for, I'd say.
Okay. When I was there, they also were telling me about letters on the bottle. What else should you be looking for if you maybe turn the bottle upside down and you see something on the bottom?
Oh, Rod, that's a very good question, which I don't have a decent answer.
Because I think it's similar to what you're talking about, is that those that grow the grapes are also producing the wine. Because, the big houses, of course, they have to source their grapes from all sorts of places, don't they? They don't grow them on site, as it were, not necessarily. And in fact, I think at Pommery, which is where I went, they did have a small field of grapes there on site where they make the champagne, and that was a special bottle that they had, that knowing that, yes, they are the ones, these are the grapes that they use, but otherwise they're sourcing them from other parts of the region.
Yeah, that's true. What basically 85% of the champagne grapes are grown by small farmers. You know, the average holding is only 2 or 3 acres, something like that. And there are thousands of these guys. They make the wine. They grow the grapes, they tend the grapes, and then they sell them to the big houses. And the big houses between them, you know, who shift, you know, annual exports, 170 million bottles. So, you know, round about 300 million bottles in total a year. They own only 15% of the land. And quite a lot of the big brands really, you know, like Pommery, don't actually have very much land. They're buying in. Now, they have long-term relationships often with these guys. You know, they've been buying grapes from them for years and years and years. So there's a relationship of trust and knowledge that's been built up. But they don't actually control, the big brands don't actually control the growing.
Are they, or is champagne still made the way that it was 100, 120, 130, 40, 50 years ago? What kind of technical developments have there been in the last 50 years or even the last 20 years? Are we making better champagne because we're doing it, you know, in a different system, different way?
Fundamentally, Rod, it's the same. It's made the same way. There's a few refinements around the edges. So the process of getting the sediment and the dead yeast cells out of the bottle of the second, after the second fermentation, that's been much more mechanized. So one of your earlier callers was talking about, you know, the hand riddling, the turning the bottles every day, slowly inclining them from horizontal down to pointing down, so that you get the plug of sediment in the bottom of the down in the neck. You freeze the neck, which was an invention of the 1880s, really, and that means the pressure pushes out the plug of sediment and dead yeast. You top it up quickly with some more wine, and then, you know, it's ready to go. Not much else has really happened that affects the basic process. What you are getting, though, is, again, this is all about this sort of drive to premiumize, drive to be able to push up the price. People are starting to age champagne in extraordinary things. There's a Veuve Clicquot, for one, Tattinger, I think, also. They're experimenting with aging the wine underwater because it's, you know, always the same temperature down there, and it apparently is a very good way of aging the wine. But other people, and this is pretty niche, this is now, and you'll know why in a moment, they're aging wine in stainless steel casks lined with 24 karat gold.
That may explain why champagne is so expensive, that's for sure. Just a couple of other questions here. Wayne wants to know, will champagne always have a cork rather than a screw top? And just tell us about the cork as well, because somebody told me that if the cork kind of shrivels up a bit after it's open, you know that it's proper cork, that if it doesn't do that, it's sort of a mix.
Most of them are now mixes. Most of them are discs of cork stuck together. But yes, if you take a champagne cork out and leave it, it will lose, ultimately it will lose that mushroom shape that you know it has when it comes out of the bottle, and it sort of becomes a sort of stubbier version of itself. It is, I think, part of the champagne regulations that it has to be with a cork rather than anything else, and it has to have that wire cage and the foil wrapped around it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they'll be changing to screw top anytime soon for the full bottle, for the 75 mil bottles. Mm-hmm. You can buy, and Pommery have experimented with this amongst others, smaller bottles, you know, 25 cl quarter bottles, things like that, which sometimes will have a screw top. Oh. But I think that, you know, the cork and champagne, you know, it goes together. They would hate not to be able to have the cork and to pop it, and for the racing drivers to spray the crown.
So those, I mean, there are various sizes of champagne bottles. Most of them we're familiar with that small one, but then you know, you've got the, you know, the Methuselahs and the Jeroboams and the Nebuchadnezzars and all that as they get much bigger and bigger and bigger. Is the flavour any better in the biggest champagne bottle compared with just the normal size that we would have, 750 mil?
The only one where it really makes a difference is with the Magnum, so 2.5 bottles rather than a single bottle. The wine in those bottles ages more slowly. And the slower it ages, basically, the better the end result is. And again, a generalisation, but it's not a bad generalisation. When you get up to the really big bottles, you know, the Nebuchadnezzars, you said Methuselahs, you know, which hold, oh, I forget how many bottles now, but, you know, dozens, yeah, scores.
16.
Those are filled from standard bottles, well, not from standard bottles, but, you know, the wine does not age in the bottle. It's really only the Magnum that it can make a difference.
So the Magnum is the best.
If you can afford it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, we've got other people asking, is champagne an aphrodisiac?
Well, it certainly excites the senses, doesn't it?
Okay.
And there was I believe that the Hollywood Hays Code, you know, which governed what you could show and what you could not show on film in the 1920s and 1930s, explicitly said there must be no champagne bottles on bedside tables.
Sure, there were no strawberries or oysters either. are the grapes stomped by foot? How are the grapes stomped?
Grapes. The foot is a great device for treading grapes. Because it's very flexible, there's not so much weight that it crushes the pips or the skins, which will give you more bitter flavours in the wine. But champagne, as far as I know, has not been trodden by foot for a very long period of time. And the reason for that is that, as I said earlier, to avoid getting colour from the skins of the black grapes, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier, you have to press very evenly and very gently. So what you're doing is you have something that was almost like more like two rollers, which slowly pass the grapes between them. So you get this very gentle, very even pressure. So that's what you need. So it's really only with, you know, heavy duty red wines, port, and one or two others that you do get still a little bit of hand treading, although I think it's one of the porthouses has invented a mechanical foot that will you can use.
All right, we've got about 4 minutes left, less than that. Do you get what you pay for when it comes to champagne? Is a really expensive champagne better than the cheapest champagne?
I would probably be shocked for saying this, but when I started working on champagne about 10 years ago, I was told that this is, you know, UK currency. If you pay more than 30 quid for a bottle of champagne, you're paying for the brand.
Mm.
Now, the numbers have changed. It's probably if you're paying more than 50 quid, you're paying for the brand. Nought else. So the answer is, I think, not really. But you do have to pay now 25, 30 quid. This is English yeah. currency to get, you know, a decent bottle, which has got a bit of age on it and a bit of complexity.
So obviously people know the major names, Veuve, Tattinger, Bollinger, Mumm, you know, Pommery. You know, are they, is that kind of the sweet spot, Paul Roger as well? Like in Australia, you are paying probably now somewhere between $60 to $90 for a bottle, which is a lot of money under the current circumstances. You might get something $45, $50 a bottle, maybe a brand you haven't heard of, but I'm sure they'd produce a perfectly good champagne, would they?
They will produce a good champagne, most of those, certainly. I suppose all I can really say is that, you know, if you buy the non-vintage standard brand from those big houses, you'll know that if you liked it last time, you'll like it this time. So there's no risk. That's what you're paying for. No risk. And of course, the fact that you've got that name on your table, you know, the name on the table, it's like, you know, the bar call with mobile phones when they were invented and created. You know, the brand name says something about you as well.
Mm. Do you keep and collect the corks and the, you know, little metal things from the top?
No, I don't. I give the corks to a friend of mine, has a deal with, I can't remember who now, but each cork that she collects, she's able to sell on and get some money for a wildlife reserve that she runs. So all my corks go to her.
What about the little, I'm not sure what they were even called, the little metal things on the top?
No, I forget, La Maille or something like that. No, I don't collect them. I think it would be too embarrassing to look back at the collection.
How much you've had. But also, there's beautiful designs for some of those, though, aren't they?
There are, yes. They are beautiful, and they don't get enough attention, which I think, you know, perhaps is your point really, Rod. Mm. They don't get the attention they deserve because they are little mini artworks in their own right.
Yeah. I'm sure a lot of people hopefully will be having some champagne this Christmas and certainly this New Year's Eve. If you had to choose your favourite, what would it be?
I think my favourite would probably be either the Pommery, which you've talked about as well, or the Paul Roger non-vintage blends. Although there's now some very good, sorry, it's a bit of a plug, English sparkling wine coming on the market, and more I'm buying that, you know, just on the basis of supporting the local guys.
Graham Harding, Professor Graham Harding, champagne historian at Oxford University, thank you so much for your time. I've really appreciated it.
A pleasure.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.